Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up in a few minutes, Elizabeth Kramer reports on Columbus, Indiana, and why it's the location of some of the country's best architecture. First, the next round of UN climate change talks is underway in Ghana this week. For some perspective on the talks and our nation's role in them, Kristen Espelon spoke with University of Kentucky political scientist Dr. Karen Mingst.
In Accra, it looks like what they're trying to do is to firm up some commitments that have to do with beyond the Kyoto Protocol, beyond 2012.
I think there's two different things. I mean, first of all, there's just a function that, you know, by 2009, at the end of 2009, they're supposed to have a replacement treaty. The second is really an education function, that is trying to bring other actors on board with agreeing to whatever terms are decided in that treaty.
And when it comes to reluctance to sign on to treaties, to agree to emissions targets, we've seen the United States, India, and China kind of band together. What do you make of that?
Well, they're doing it for very different interests. You know, the United States has been, for a long time, said there's no problem. You know, did not admit that there was a problem. And I should say the United States administration has been in power for the last 8 years, did not recognize that global climate change was a problem and therefore was reluctant to take any steps. Once the science became quite convincing that it indeed was a major problem and something that could be done, then the U.S. approach has always been that we need to have flexible standards, that the private sector, the market economy will begin to address this, that we don't need targets, that we don't need national targets. India and China, for quite a different reason, say, first of all, that as developing countries, they shouldn't be subject to all of the same restrictions that the developed world is, but they're also against targets. They don't want to cut back on what they see as their right to develop economically. And yet the European Union and much of the rest of the developed world has said that this is the only way that that really can be achieved, is through the setting of the targets and then developing a lot of flexible mechanisms in order to achieve those targets.
What do you think is actually going to be accomplished in Ghana?
I think it's really much more the educational function and trying to very slowly bring the developing world on board and calling attention to the tropical deforestation issue. You know, I don't think that the Ghana will solve the basic problem of the U.S., who have been, in my view, obstructionists the whole way. You know, without the U.S. on board and making a strong commitment and a political commitment to changing our attitude about it, I don't think this or any other treaty is going to be successful. What I think is really interesting in all of this is that while you saw the reluctance and the obstructionist nature of the U.S. at the national level, what we've seen is, you know, the private sector beginning to make adjustments, to beginning to change. We've seen state governments, California being among the most important, make significant changes. We've seen a lot of local commitments that are much farther ahead than the national political, the central government.
Given the complexity of these negotiations and the number of parties involved, is an international treaty still worth pursuing, in your opinion?
In one sense, an international treaty, and it's called a framework treaty, provides sort of an overarching framework from within then countries can and local jurisdictions and can kind of put their efforts or aim their efforts. I think there are some benefits to it, but in one sense, you're right. What has happened is that the failure of Kyoto to really become effective, partly because of the obstructionist view of the U.S., has promoted a much more decentralization of approach.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mingst.
Mm-hmm.
The architecture in Columbus, Indiana, makes it one of the country's most important cities. That's according to the American Institute of Architects. Native son J. Irwin Miller owned the city's largest employer, the Cummins Engine Company, and helped pay the design fees for buildings by world-renowned architects. Miller died 4 years ago, and now some people in Columbus are questioning if new construction is spoiling the legacy he left. Elizabeth Kramer reports.
J. Irwin Miller was smitten with modern architecture. and his passion propelled the construction in Columbus of more than 60 buildings designed by internationally known architects. In the 1930s, he tapped Finnish architect Eliel Saarinen to design a new home for the First Christian Church. Finished in 1942, this first modernist church in the country is a simple box shape made up of limestone, taupe brick, and glass. 12 years later, Miller extended his influence to civic buildings. He set up the Cummins Foundation, which worked with developers to identify world-famous architects. Since 1954, it has paid $25 million in design fees for civic buildings in town. The first project was the Lillian Schmidt Elementary School, which opened in 1957. The classrooms here have A-shaped ceilings that mirror the roofs of nearby houses. The octagon-shaped library is lined with planks of wood and topped off with skylights that flood the stacks with sunlight. 30-year-old Kelly Adams has a son in the third grade at the school. She remembers when her sister went to school here and how she used to ride her bike exploring the city. Back then, Adams really didn't understand that architecture made Columbus significant.
It was just a playground for me, and then growing up now, I appreciate, you know, the artists that did make somewhat of their name here and make Columbus kind of the architectural drawing point that it is.
Adams used to play under the large Henry Moore sculpture outside the library designed by architect I.M. Pei, who also designed the glass pyramid at the Louvre. She also went to the indoor playground at the Commons. Built in 1973, it was one of the first enclosed urban malls. Today, the Commons has been reduced to its shell to make way for a conference center, a hotel, an office building, and other private businesses. But after much public input, the new Commons will retain some of its community space, including the indoor playground and a small theater. Tom Vojovich is president of the city's Redevelopment Commission. It was formed in 2003 and pushed for building a downtown garage and remaking the Commons, which was no longer attracting people into the city. Standing atop the garage, Vojovich calls it a first for Columbus.
We've debated for 50 years whether there was a need for a garage. We finally got over that. We built it.
Some people like Kelly Adams say the garage and other structures, like the new Indigo Hotel 2 blocks east, could threaten that legacy. They call them unremarkable buildings that can go up fairly quickly without a huge price tag. But Vojovich insists these designs do blend with the existing architecture. He says projects like this hotel are needed to bring more business.
We think it's a product that fits in real well with the downtown. We did market studies that indicated a need for more hotels, more guest rooms in the community.
Vojovich says boosting economic activity in a time of falling tax revenues and tight budgets has required some compromises. Those compromises are justified, says Alan Brake. Brake is associate editor of the Architect's newspaper and has written about Columbus.
Some of the building that's going on there now might not be of international caliber, but I think from an economic development standpoint, it's probably very smart.
Brake says Columbus, like many cities, is finding it needs to revitalize its downtown to bring in business and fortify its public coffers. Brake and Vojovich say that the days of patronage that came from the likes of J. Irwin Miller are gone. The large companies that they built, like Cummins, often still contribute to their communities, but they also have interests in other cities and in satisfying their stockholders. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
Last week, Kentucky's two candidates for U.S. Senate shared a venue for the first time this campaign season, excluding the annual Fancy Farm picnic. Republican incumbent Mitch McConnell and Democratic challenger Bruce Lunsford took part in a Measure the Candidates Forum at the Kentucky Farm Bureau headquarters in Louisville. During the forum, members of KFB's board presented the candidates with issues related to the agriculture community and then asked each a couple of questions on the topic. Here's a portion of that forum.
We know firsthand the importance of a strong farm policy to the security of our nation. So to discuss that topic is Mr. Eddie Melton, chair of our Feed, Grains, and Wheat Advisory Committee. Eddie lives down at Seabree and operates a grain and beef cattle operation. Eddie?
Thanks, Marshall, and I do appreciate you two gentlemen coming today and meeting with us today to hear issues that are important to Kentucky agriculture. And like Marshall said, I want to talk about national farm policy. You know, a strong agricultural base is essential to any nation's long-term success and security. American farmers produce the safest, most abundant, and most economical supply of food and fiber in the world. Agriculture is also playing a significant role in the production of renewable energy. Sound national farm policy is critical to maintaining a strong agriculture in the United States. The recently passed 2008 Farm Bill reflected many of the positive elements of the 2002 Farm Bill, which maintained the three-legged safety net for agriculture while enhancing beginning farmers, fruits and vegetable crops, and livestock. Kentucky Farm Bureau policy advocates maintaining this safety net and focusing conservation programs on working lands. Our policy also advocates USDA maintain an effective and efficient way to deliver these programs to farmers. As you know, during your term in office, we'll be writing a new farm bill. We just finished one, but we're going to be writing another one during this term of office. Two questions I would like to pose to you gentlemen. The first is, what measures should Congress take to ensure American agriculture has the support needed to continue producing the food and fiber this country will need in the future? And second, how would you further strengthen farm policy to emphasize and strengthen American agriculture? Thank y'all.
Thank you, Eddie. And we'll begin our remarks on this subject with Senator McConnell. Senator?
Well, the struggle in the Farm Bill is basically between feeding programs and environmental efforts and maintaining the commodity programs, the safety net. And over the years, farm bills have evolved from being strictly a farm consideration to being one, I know the Speaker of the House, for example, viewed it basically as a nutrition bill. So there are these competing elements in every farm bill debate going back and forth among them. When you get to final passage, the farm bills in the Senate are typically pretty popular. But it is a struggle because of the various elements competing within a farm bill. Farm programs and commodity programs are actually at a disadvantage competing with other programs that are arguably much more popular to some in the political marketplace of ideas. The other thing that's absolutely critical in terms of the future is doing something about energy prices. The natural gas has had an enormous impact on the cost of your fertilizer. America could be entirely independent in natural gas. Natural gas prices are not a world price, they're a domestic price. If we simply produced enough natural gas to take care of our needs, we could control the price of natural gas, which would have a positive impact on the cost of fertilizer. In addition to that, there is the cost of fuel. There is no question that a perfect storm has developed as a result of worldwide supply and demand. And the Indians and the Chinese are getting more prosperous. They're not going to go backward. They expect to have a better lifestyle, and in order to do that and to have a prosperous economy, obviously, vehicles become a big part of the equation. How do we solve our energy problems? We need to do absolutely everything. Most of the members of my conference, I think almost without exception, are for every form of renewable energy. Obviously, we're producing ethanol in Hopkinsville, and Alltech is going to put in a new facility with a $30 million starter grant from DOE that moves in the direction of developing cellulosic product into ethanol. Agriculture is an integral part of solving the energy problem. We need to do it all. More nuclear, more coal to liquid. We've got a purchaser for coal to liquid. It's the U.S. military. You've got the commercial airliners who would love to have coal to liquid. So when somebody asks you what should America do to lower energy costs, which has a direct bearing on your operation, your farming operation, and the cost of the price of food for the consumer, we need to do everything, move on all fronts simultaneously.
Mr. Lunsford?
I guess the speaker works there. Can everybody hear that? Okay. Let me say a couple things about that. Let's talk about this idea of leadership and experience and inexperience. You know, my experience is probably as diversified as anybody who's run for this office over the years, because many people begin their careers early as politicians. I don't think there's any question that the differing factor here, number one, in this election is that I am someone who is an outsider because I've spent my years in lots of businesses, including agriculture, and still do today. I've also spent it and businesses that are really dependent over the years on government regulation and government support. As a result of that, I understand the impact of what happens in Washington with what happens in real life. And as you've probably heard often over the last several months, there's been quite a discussion and debate about where we go, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat coming into November. And I think the difference is becoming more stark because the Republicans have an awful lot to deal with of what's happened in this economy, what's happened with our energy over the last 6 years and 8 years of this administration. The Farm Bill is one of those things that, generally speaking, has a great opportunity to pass in almost every session because there's a lot of agriculture base in this country. But the things that go in that bill that could help the farmer in Kentucky, could help the farmer across the country, I believe can come much more effectively from a senator who actually understands what it is to cut tobacco in the fall, trying to get done before dark, from someone who understands the importance to get hay in before rains come, from someone who has had a background of being raised on a farm with the values. You know, probably, you know, when I was in high school, I carried around a tobacco knife and a spear in my trunk so I could make extra money after school with a couple of my friends. I always get the feeling that with Senator McConnell's background, that he had a briefcase in the back of his in high school. And I think we come from totally different backgrounds. I also believe my background in marketing could be of great help as a U.S. Senator. And let's look at what is going to happen the next 6 years. The majority of the Senate is not going to be the Republican Party. The majority of the Senate is going to be the Democratic Party. And I've spent my life being a pretty good compromiser and salesman. And there's going to be a new group of senators in Washington in January. And I expect to be one of them. And I expect to be one of the most effective and most influential in the Democratic Party. It's a great opportunity to change what we've been doing in the past, because if we don't, we're not going to have the bright future everybody in this room wants for their children and their grandchildren.
Our next issue is on trade and marketing. To make that presentation, we have our first Vice President, Mr. Mark Haney. Mark's from Pulaski County. Not only serves as our first Vice President, but serves as chair of our state's resolutions committee, farms and orchard, and beef cattle and other items there in Pulaski County. So, Mark.
Thank you, Marshall. And Senator, Mr. Lunsford, I certainly want to thank you for bringing your campaigns to Farm Bureau. It's a good day. We appreciate that very, very much. You know, because of the more open world market that we're seeing right now, we see a much increased demand for U.S. agricultural products. The forecast for 2008 agricultural exports is a little more than $108 billion, up about 25% over 2007, along with agriculture imports at about three-fourths of that number, about $78 billion. A lot of that is contributed to higher prices, we know that, but also it's the fact that we're moving a lot of product. And we know that that's good for U.S. agriculture. We know that's good for the U.S. economy. We believe that increased trade contributes to certainly better marketing opportunities. Because of better marketing opportunities, we can build stronger markets. We can increase in production, and the outcome of that is we can build more wealth here in the United States and certainly here in Kentucky. Kentucky's share of that agricultural exporting in 2007 was over $1 billion. So that's important. That's important to Kentucky. We were disappointed that the Doha round of WTO had stalled out this year, but We see the importance of trade agreements, both bilateral and multinational trade agreements. It's we believe in a fair and open market and open trade. We believe that it's a good opportunity right now. As we hear, we talk about the dollar being a little bit weak right now. Well, we see that also as an opportunity to be able to make U.S. products a better buy for in foreign trade. So we would like to be able to see everything that we could put us in a competitive advantage in that area. So my question for you today is, what are your views regarding the benefit of trade agreements? And as a U.S. senator, how would you work with a U.S. trade representative in Congress to make sure that all Kentucky commodities are treated fairly in trade agreements and in future legislation that promotes international trade? Again, thank you very much.
Hey, and thank you, Mark, for your presentation. For comments on trade and marketing, we'll begin with Mr. Lunsford.
Okay. Well, I think the question, I led into a little bit in the first question, was that what we have right now is a tremendous agricultural opportunity. Now, as an American, I don't think it's positive they have the dollar that's discounted by 40% over the last 6 years. But as an opportunist in the agricultural community, it's a wonderful opportunity. It's a chance to market what this country offers in other places, and where you know that you can create an imbalance our way rather than the imbalance the other way. And so after I spent the day a couple days ago in Hopkinsville and got to see the ethanol plant there and to watch how a group of farmers have put together a program like that and have used their own skills to efficiently and effectively produce byproduct out of that was just remarkable to me, that they could run, I guess, 16 billion bushels of corn through there. At a time when corn in 2005 was, $2 plus a bushel, and today it's, approached, I guess, $6 at times, even more. What an opportunity. And that's only one of many. And for those farmers who've chosen well, the last 2 to 3 years have been really great opportunity times. Opportunity to secure your future, opportunity to reduce your debt, opportunity to secure your farm for your children, grandchildren. And I think that's great. But we all know those go like this in agriculture. And it's very important that you're represented in a fair and effective way from Kentucky and understand the importance of trade agreements, that you cover bad times, you build long-term agreements, that you be able to trade your products back and forth. And everyone in this room, because you are, have been elected as leaders of the farming community with over 450,000 members, you have a responsibility on your shoulders to do the right things for Kentucky agriculture. And with agriculture being my base and the rural base of this state, I can't imagine going to Washington and not making it your passion. I would love that opportunity because, first of all, I love marketing. I think it has a wonderful opportunity. And we do make, as you said, Marshall, you not only have the best Farm Bureau, we have the best farmers in the country. I've known many of them generations, two or three in this room today, who I knew your fathers. That's one thing. Kentucky has always risen above the crowd. We do not take a back seat to anybody. And we don't need anything but the best effort from U.S. Senator. We don't need to hold hostage things for contributions. We need to hold our values and your values in place. And that's what will protect American farmers and Kentucky farmers.
Senator?
Well, you'll notice he didn't answer the question. Bruce is supported by the AFL-CIO. According to the newspaper, he's made every commitment they ask him to make in order to get their support. They oppose trade promotion authority, which the Democratic Congress has let expire. Without trade promotion authority, there won't be any more trade deals. There are four pending trade deals that were at the beginning of the Congress, four of them, that could still be approved. The Democratic majority has only been willing to approve Peru. Colombia, Panama, and Korea are still pending. This is the anti-trade party. The AFL-CIO doesn't want any trade deals with anybody. opposing Colombia is particularly absurd. Right now, Colombian goods come into this country duty-free. Only our goods going there have to pay duties. Mr. Lunsford's party frequently says, why don't we have any friends in the world? Well, Colombia is one of our greatest friends, a big American ally sitting right next to Evo Morales in Bolivia and Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. So it has foreign policy implications as well. He's not going to be for any of these trade agreements which allow you to sell your products abroad because the AFL-CIO is not going to let him. Also, this suggestion that somehow a freshman senator would be able to have influence in Washington, let me explain to him, and I think all of you already know how the Senate works. In the Senate, a simple majority is not enough. It requires bipartisan cooperation to do almost anything in the Senate. As a freshman member of the majority party, which he would be if he were to be elected, he would have a minuscule amount of influence, and there was an interesting study done by the National Journal, which covers Congress recently, looking at freshman Democratic senators in this Congress. From my point of view, there are entirely too many of them, but there were quite a few. They picked Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania as the most effective member of the freshman class in terms of directed congressional funding for his state. He was able to get $16 million for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. That's a state, what, 3.5 to 4 times as big as ours. Your senator, the guy you're looking at, brought home $500 million last year for the Commonwealth. As the leader of the minority party in the United States Senate. And in my closing statement, I'm going to remind everybody again of some of those items, including I see Scott, the Dean of the College of Agriculture at UK, sitting here around the table, is on your board. $45 million for the College of Agriculture over the last 10 years alone. I'm a free trader, and I can deliver for Kentucky agriculture in the future as I have in the past.
That was part of a forum last week featuring U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell and the man trying to unseat him, Democratic challenger Bruce Lunsford. The two met at the event held by the Kentucky Farm Bureau in Louisville. When we come back, we'll talk with William Maypother. The actor from the TV show Lost is in Louisville for a performance with Actors Theater. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Still to come in this week's show, Robin Fisher talks with author and life coach Maria Nemeth about money and the energy that surrounds it. First, Actors Theater of Louisville starts its run of the acclaimed play Glengarry Glen Ross on Tuesday. Among the actors bringing the play to life will be William Maypother. He spoke with Alan Brandt of our sister station, Classical 90.5.
First off, just to give you an idea, William, you're a bluegrass native.
I am. I grew up in Louisville. I went to St. Leonard Grade School and then St. X before I left to go away for college in New York and L.A.
And you may know William as Ethan on the ABC show Lost, so that'll give you a better, clearer picture.
One of the others.
But you are playing a major character in Glengarry Glen Ross, which is a David Mamet play. And I'm sure a lot of people have seen the movie or seen the play itself. But you're playing Richard Roma, who smooth-talking, successful salesman. And the whole idea of the play is what? What's the whole? I mean, they're all going for a goal, aren't they? These characters.
Well, it's about a group of somewhat unscrupulous real estate salesmen, and something happens about halfway through the play, and I don't want to give it away, but that forms the central conflict in the play, and it helps reveal all the characters' true character, as it were. And it's a very gritty, dark comedy, as it were.
And Mamet seems to excel at the darker shades of life, but also in the development of character reacting or acting to another character. Another Mamet feature, though, is his writing. He will write a conversation that doesn't normally occur in normal life. People don't talk like a Mamet play necessarily.
No, but it may be less a matter of black and white in that matter than a matter of degree. How often do they talk in the way they do it in a Neal play or a Williams play or a Shakespearean play? But I think you're right in the way that they don't talk. And certainly in Mammoth, there's a lot more cursing, there's a lot more circularity, a lot more repetition of phrasing, and there's a lot more aggression. I'm not the first one who has noticed that in Mammoth, the characters often use words as weapons, as they do with in Harold Pinter's plays. Mm-hmm. And Pinter was Glengarry Glen Ross is dedicated to Harold Pinter. David Mamet sent it to Pinter and asked his opinion, and Pinter wrote back, "The only thing this play is lacking is a production." And he helped get the first production mounted in London.
Well, it seems like Mamet, among a lot of, compared to other playwrights, seems to have a poet's approach to the text. He uses as little words as necessary to get a precise meaning across.
He does. It's in some ways, you're absolutely right. What he will often do is repeat phrases. Characters often, it seems, sometimes have trouble expressing themselves, so they will repeat the same phrases or words again and again. But he certainly has a poet's sensibility. You're right about that.
If you've just joined us, we're talking to actor William Maypother, who is part of Actors Theatre's new production of Glengarry Glen Ross. Now, as for your character, Richard Roma, how much of the character is fleshed out before you get on stage? And how much can you add to that character as an actor?
Well, that's a very broad question and a very specific one simultaneously. It is specific because you're asking me, and every actor will have a different answer. And it's a broad question because it depends upon the production. Mm-hmm. And it even depends upon the medium, whether you're doing a play or a film role or a television role. You often have different amounts of time of preparation. And in this case, a close reading of the text reveals a lot more character than the first couple readings will. The character's thoughts, especially in Mammoth, the characters jump often within a speech and make leaps of logic and thought and transition. And that reveals a great deal about the character's intentions and thinking patterns. What's left is the character's emotional states, the blocking the physical movement, the physical life of the character. And certainly with any great writing, if it's sufficiently specific, it's also sufficiently universal, and so it's open to some interpretation to a degree. Mm-hmm. So that is a very long-witted answer. A shorter answer would be some of the work is done for me and some of the work I have to do.
Right. Well, is Mamet careful about productions of his work, or does he leave it open for a director to reset the time and place of something?
That's a good question. I don't know. He, as far as I know, has not been involved or in contact with the director of this play. And the director of our play, of our production, is Mark Masterson, who is also the artistic director at Actors Theatre. We are setting it in the time in which it was originally set, which is the early 80s. Mm-hmm. So we haven't tampered with the time or place. The setting is Chicago.
I suppose, given what it is, where it's set, you've got real estate agents working, and I'm sure you don't have too much wiggle room. You can't set it in the 1800s.
No, it'd be difficult. And there's a matter of characters having difficulty communicating without landlines, without their phones. So it'd be difficult, without altering the text, to move it up much past 1995 when everyone had cell phones.
That's true. So working in Louisville at Actors, as a professional actor, you have the screen time. You're on television and movies. What, as an actor, do you get from being in front of a live audience?
The audience and its feedback serves in a way as an additional character in the play. You know, when you're performing a scene, you can set and prepare and intend as much as you want, but you really are constrained by the performance of the person working opposite you to a degree. In other words, you have to react to them within a certain degree. And the audience provides in a similar way the sort of energy and feedback that you don't in the way that another character would. And you don't get that, obviously, in film and television. In film, you can go to a theater and watch, hear an audience react, but they aren't participating in the creation of the piece. Mm-hmm. And there isn't the sense of working without a net that there is in stage. It's a lot more fun.
I do want to ask you one more question about it, since I'm not a professional actor, but I'm fascinated by live performance. I experienced some of it as a singer, but audiences can be drastically different from one production to the next. Does the audience reaction sometimes determine how you approach your character to say your lines and deliver your character's speeches?
Well, that's a good question. And I think there are two possible ways in which they could affect it. One is within the performance itself. And the second is from one performance to the next. If at a certain portion of the play, one or more of the actors or the director notices that the audience seems restless, then the director or the actors might alter their performances for the remainder of the run of the play because they figure there's something off. But within a given performance, that's a good question. Certainly if an audience laughs, you have to hold and you have to wait so that they catch the next line. But it's a very delicate balance, because if you have somebody opening a gum wrapper or someone being restless or someone coughing, you can't let that distract you to a certain degree. So it's within a given performance, the audience participation, their effect, needs to be limited a bit by the actor.
Well, I've always found an admirable quality to be able to memorize lines and say them in front of a live audience and do it for so long.
Actors often call that public privacy. In other words, you are having a private conversation with another actor, as you might in a restaurant if you're having an intimate conversation with your partner. But you're surrounded by other people and you're aware of them, but you can't let it to a degree affect your right. private conversation.
William, thank you for coming in, and have great success with it.
Thank you, Alan. I'm really thrilled to be at Actors and back in Louisville.
Glengarry Glen Ross opens Tuesday at Actors Theater. More information is available at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, tips for mastering the money in your life. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Everyone says it. I don't have the time or the money. But do we know what that really means? According to author Maria Nemeth, it's all about managing our life's energies. Robin Fisher talked with Nemeth about her books, Mastering Life's Energies and The Energy of Money.
In your books, especially the two, Mastering Life's Energies and The Energy of Money, the one thing that, of course, grabs you immediately is that they are concerned with energy.
Yes.
So how are you using energy in these books? How do you define energy?
That's a good question, Robin. There are six kinds of energy that you and I are here to learn how to use in order to make our goals a reality. So the six kinds of energy are these: the energy of money, and believe it or not, money is simply a form of energy. Joseph Campbell, who was a well-known author, said that money is congealed energy. We can hold it in our hands and do things with it. And I've found, Robin, that when people who are successful with money talk about money, they see it as a form of energy. You can either use it wisely or you can waste it. You can focus it or you can lose track of it. So energy of money is one. The next is the energy of time. And it's kind of interesting. We almost intuitively know that money and time are forms of energy, because we talk about wasting time, don't we, and wasting money and investing time and investing money. It's, at some level, we know that they're energies. The next kind of energy is the energy of physical vitality, which is related to our ability
to do the things that we really want to do in life because we have the physical energy. The next energy is the energy of enjoyment. And when we learn how to focus enjoyment on a day-to-day basis on what we're doing, we're focusing a very special kind of energy because what you enjoy grows. The next energy is the energy of creativity. And once again, we can almost intuit that it's energy because we talk about investing our creative juices or wasting our creativity, focusing it or not. So creativity really means, Robin, our ability to see what it is that we truly want in life, what is unique to us, and then going out and getting it. And the final energy is the energy of relationship, meaning our ability to form relationships with other people that are supportive of us and supportive of them. I think one of the things, for instance, if we were to look at the Olympics that are going on right now as an example, all the athletes say that they wouldn't be where they were without the support of very important key people in their lives. So the energy of support is something we've come here to learn how to use consciously as well.
I want to go back to something that you said in the beginning. The first book that I read was The Energy of Money. And one thing that struck me, and you just alluded to it, is that we use the same language when we are talking about money or we are talking about time.
Yes, we do.
And why is that? Why are they so interconnected in our lives? And you use money in that book, not as the energy of money, how you are spending your money, but more money as it reflects your life philosophy.
Exactly. Money, how you're using money as it reflects what's important to you, whether or not you are being conscious. And, you know, let's look. What are the two reasons, Robin, that people normally use for not having what they want in life or going for a goal? They say, I don't have the what?
Time or money.
Exactly. They're linked in our minds. They're linked. And we've heard all those sayings, money is time and time is money. But you see, when we go underneath those slogans, we can see that we have this concept of energy and that you and I are here to become conscious conduits of energy. Now, a conduit is something that can conduct energy from one place to another. And sometimes a conduit, like a water pipe, can be all full of sludge. So the energy doesn't get from, let's say, a lake to the garden of our goals and dreams. But one of the things that we're here to do in life is to clear ourselves, to become conscious conduits of energy, so that the energy we do have, we're putting it precisely where we want. You know, often people who say, I don't have enough money or I don't have enough time, that may not be the case. It may be the case that you're not awake to how you're using your money and your time, which if you could wake up and become conscious, you could have what you want, and you could have it with clarity, focus, ease, and grace.
Well, would you tell us the story of the woman in The Energy of Money who never balanced her checkbook?
Oh, yeah, oh boy. Yes, true story. One woman always rounded her checkbook up. You know how we do it? Like if I write a check for $17.95, I round it up to $18 in my checkbook, so I'm always, you know, using round numbers. Well, she did that herself, had not balanced her checkbook. Finally, in one of the courses that she had taken with me, one of my exercises was you must balance your checkbook. So she did. She went back about 5 years, and she found that she had a bunch of money. I think it was $795 in her account that she didn't know she had because she was rounding up all those years. She said, you know, this was wonderful, but I got very angry. And I said, why? She said, because some friends have been asking me if I wanted to go on a cruise. A couple months ago, they asked, and I said no because I didn't have the money. She said, but I had the money. I was just unconscious about it. So I'm not saying that that's necessarily true for everyone or what happened to her, but when we become conscious about how we're using our money, we end up naturally focusing it toward what has real meaning and heart for us, what's really, what we really want to spend it on.
Well, the one thing that struck me about both Mastering Life's Energies and The Energy of Money is that you really put the responsibility for change in the hands of the reader. I mean, there are no magic mantras. There's no secret formula. It's just something, I mean, you do have to do it yourself.
Well, and isn't that wonderful?
Yeah,
actually. Really, I mean, let's face it. It's so wonderful. And, you know, if I have to do it myself, then wouldn't it be great to have some simple principles to follow? And that's what I've dedicated my life to do is to distill out from all the great wisdom traditions, what are the simple principles that we can follow, which when we follow them, allow us to shift our lives from, well, in many cases, from scarcity to abundance. But it's so wonderful that it's up to us.
Tell me what you mean by from the great wisdom traditions.
Well, you know, if we were to read the Bible, if you were to read Buddhist writings, if you were to read the Bhagavad Gita, if you were to read, you know, if you were to read Henry David Thoreau, Emerson, all of the people, Gandhi, people who we consider to be brilliant in their lives, we see that they're pointing to certain principles that are universal. You know, certainly unity points to principles that are universal. Science of mind does the same. When we distill out what all the great wisdom traditions are teaching us, number one, they're teaching us that we do have to do it ourselves. There's no way for us to wish that something would appear and make it so, at least not on this planet, in this lifetime, but that it's really incumbent upon us to find out, to become clear about what is important, then to learn how to focus our energy, then to learn how to take easy steps instead of rushing in all at once, taking huge steps that leave us in a ringer, and then finally, that teach us how to find the grace that is surrounding us always. So clarity, focus, ease, and grace, which I talk about a lot, especially in the Mastering Life's Energies book, these four principles give us a way of living our dreams instead of, you know, standing on the sideline and not doing what it is we want to be doing in life.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
That was Robin Fisher talking with author and life coach Maria Nemeth about her books, Mastering Life's Energies and The Energy of Money. Nemeth will conduct workshops in Louisville. The workshops are sponsored by Unity of Louisville. For more information, visit our website, WFPL.org. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.